The Old Testament scrolls. I want to talk about two things tonight. The number of Old Testament manuscripts and the accuracy of the Old Testament manuscripts. As you know, the Bible in our hands, in the Old Testament, was written in Hebrew. The New Testament was written in Greek. We do not have any original manuscripts. They've all perished. None in the Old Testament, none of the New Testament. Why they perished in the providence of God is only a matter of speculation. Some believe that surely they would be worshipped if they were here, just like the brazen serpent in the wilderness was later discovered and worshipped. I personally think it's more likely so that nobody could corrupt them, because if somebody got their hands on the original manuscripts that were breathed out by God, and they were the sole custodian of the sole original manuscript, they could easily corrupt it. Instead, God decided to scatter them all over the world, making it impossible for them to be corrupted. There are 10,000 Old Testament manuscripts. There's no way humanly possible that somebody could find all 10,000 manuscripts all over the world and corrupt them. In the New Testament, we have 5,700, and the same thing is true. So I think it makes it beyond corruptibility by human hands. The number of Old Testament manuscripts, as we indicated, more than 10,000. 10,000 manuscripts in Hebrew, dating from 250 B.C. to 1100 A.D. Now, until the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, most of them were around 9 to 1100 A.D. They provided for us manuscripts going back 1,000 years earlier than the manuscripts we had before. The earliest fragment we had before was the Nash Papyri, about 2nd century B.C. to 1st century A.D., and its contents were just the famous Shema of Deuteronomy 6, the Lord our God is one. Two fragments of the Decalogue, Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5, which contain that. Now, this was the oldest Old Testament manuscript before 1947. That was it, and it was only a fragment. A larger manuscript dated at 820 AD to 850. It's called Oriental 4445 manuscript, housed in the British Museum. That has Deuteronomy, less Numbers 7, 43 to 77. And, it's a very good manuscript, as you can see from the clarity of it. Codex Cariensis, dated about 895 A.D., had the former and latter prophets found in Egypt and housed in the Holy Land. See the columns, three columns in which the Hebrew is written. Then there was the Aleppo Codex from 930 A.D., the whole Old Testament, conditioned very good, housed in a Hebrew university in the Holy Land. Then there was Codex Leningradensis, about 1008 A.D., one of the oldest complete Old Testament manuscripts. In fact, if you've ever seen a Hebrew Bible, it's this manuscript that is used as the basic text for the Hebrew Bible. And it's very valuable, and it's got a symbol that is used with it, and it's the symbol L for the Leningradensis. And, of course, it was housed in Leningrad. Here is, if you want a crossword puzzle to work on, here's 10,000 Cairo Genizo manuscripts. They found them in a storage place in Egypt near a synagogue. 10,000 pieces and manuscripts, and scholars like crossword puzzles sit there and put these things together. Absolutely amazing. Found in Egypt in a storehouse dated 929 to 1121, now scattered throughout the world. Other Genizan manuscripts have been found in other places, just means a storage place. The most important manuscript discovery of all time, though, with no close seconds, the Dead Sea Scrolls, discovered in caves by the Dead Sea, 1947 to 1956. Here's a beautiful picture of the shoreline of the Dead Sea, such as the place where the manuscripts were found. Here's the actual place, the Dead Sea Qumran area, the northwest side corner of the Dead Sea. This is a picture of the Holy Land with the Dead Sea in the bottom there, the Jordan River flowing into it. And Qumran is right there in the northwest corner. Some of you may have been there. I've been there. Here's another picture, Qumran. And you can see it's just east of Jerusalem and south of Jericho. And it was a neat place because of the temperature, because of the lack of humidity in the air, and because of its relative seclusion from Jerusalem and the busy life there. When it was unearthed, it looked something like that, an aerial view of Qumran, which you could see if you flew over today. See in the bottom right-hand side of the picture, there are people massed there for a tour of the site. This is a picture from the site itself looking out at the Dead Sea, looking toward the southeast. Here is Cave 1. These manuscripts were found in caves hidden away there for centuries. The manuscripts come from 100 to about 250 B.C. So having been found in 1947, you can see that these manuscripts are now over 2,000 years old. And for them to be preserved in itself is a miracle. Inside Cave 1, a picture what it looked like from the inside out. Cave 4, where most of the scrolls were found, in order to secure them, they took them to higher positions, which would be almost impossible for a normal person to climb to and to get to, and so they were very safe over the years. Closer view of Caves 4A and 4B on the side of the mountain there. And an interior view of Qumran Cave 4. Cave 11 was where a very unusual thing was found, the temple scroll. It was a brass scroll that had secret hiding places of hidden treasure that they were never able to find, but was very fascinating. And you can see this, all the stones taken out of the cave there, which was plugged up so that people couldn't get into them. Now here are all the locations, 15 miles east of Jerusalem, caves 3 through 11, 1 and 2, and caves 4 through 10, all there nestled on the shores of the Dead Sea. These are the two Bedouins who discovered the scrolls. They weren't quite sure whether it was still December of 46 or January of 47, but their sheep, they were tending, wandered, and one of them wandered away, and in order to find them, one of the shepherds found a hole in the cave and threw a rock down in there, and he heard something crack, and it was some of the jars that housed these manuscripts, and they were the unwitting discoverers of the greatest manuscripts of all time. Their stone broke one of these clay jars like this. The manuscript scrolls were put inside the jars, helped further preserve them, which it did for all of those many years. Now here are the number of biblical fragments that were found in the Dead Sea area. 20 fragments of Genesis, 17 of Exodus, 15 fragments of Leviticus, and so on, over 200 fragments there of every book of the Old Testament except Esther. No piece of the book of Esther was found. So it provided for us a peek in what the status of the text was 1,000 years earlier than our manuscripts, the earliest manuscripts that we had in our possession. That means we had a good way to cross-check how accurately it was copied for 1,000 years. And you'll see when we talk about it later, it was amazing accuracy for 1,000 years of copying. This looks a little better than the Cairo Geniza, but the manuscripts, look at all the pieces spread out on the table there, coming from the various manuscripts, trying to put them together and make sense out of them and use them to verify the authenticity of the Old Testament. Members of the early Dead Sea Scroll editorial team They included Roman Catholics and Greek Catholics and Protestants and Jews, a number of names with which you're maybe not familiar, but scholars are familiar, and they're taking a break from their studies. These are some of the people who worked with the research team. And again, we have people who represent the various traditions from Greek and Roman Catholic to Jewish and Protestant as well. Here's a piece of a commentary. Now, they numbered them by the caves, so 1Q would be cave number 1, and then the last few letters, H-A-B, that would be abbreviation for Habakkuk. So here's a commentary on the Old Testament book of Habakkuk, titled 1Q-P-H-A-B. Here's a fragment of Samuel. Now, this happens to be one of the oldest fragments known of the Old Testament. It goes back to 225 B.C. That would be 2,200 years ago. A piece of the book of Samuel found in the Dead Sea area. This is the oldest one on the left, Paleo Exodus 4Q22, meaning cave 4. And that's 250 B.C. Now, I don't think most of us would look that well preserved after 2,200 years. And look at how well preserved the war rule is from cave 11. Here's a Hosea, the book of Hosea scroll, late 1st century B.C. that was found. Here's a piece of Ecclesiastes, also called Koheleth in the Hebrew, 4Q109. Here's a Leviticus scroll. Now, this is how most of us probably would look if we were rolled up in a jar for 2,000 years. When they unrolled us, we'd probably look very much like this scroll. It looks like a prune that got pulled apart. Psalm 11Q5 of the book of Psalms. And then the most famous scroll of all time, the scroll that's the background for our presentation here, Isaiah A scroll, 100 B.C., most important, most valuable piece of manuscript in the entire world. And it's housed in the a museum that was made for it and the other there in Palestine. There's a picture of it, just of the piece unrolled. It was almost, with the exception of those couple little pieces there on the outer coating, almost perfectly preserved manuscript from 100, the first century B.C. They found another Isaiah scroll, which is called Isaiah B, not nearly as good a shape and many more pieces, but it too is one of the important finds. Here's a comparison of the languages in the scrolls. On the left, Hebrew, in the middle, ancient Hebrew, and on the right, Greek. And you can see it's all Greek to me, as somebody said, because it's very different shape. Almost looks like Paleo-Hebrew, almost looks like hieroglyphics. Here's the Shrine of the Book Museum in Jerusalem, where these are housed. Here's a view inside. Of course, it's kept in perfect conditions, climatically in there, to preserve the scrolls even longer. When the scrolls were here in Charlotte, as some of you indicated last week you had seen them, this is what they looked like. They were put in cases like this and preserved there, and you were able to see them as lights flashed on and off the scrolls. Where were they found? Well, they were found at Qumran, near the northwest side of the Dead Sea. Very beautiful area. When were they found? Between 1947 and 1956. How valuable are they? Well, William F. Albright, who was the greatest archaeologist of the 20th century, said, "This is the greatest manuscript discovery of modern times." How old are they? 250 B.C. to 70 A.D. The Old Testament was written between 1500 B.C. and 400. Moses lived around 1500 B.C. David lived about 1,000 B.C., and then the Old Testament ended about 400 in the time of Malachi and Nehemiah. So the Old Testament was written between about 1,500 and 400 B.C., and the earliest manuscripts we have are now only 150 years later from the time that the Old Testament was completed. We don't have any original manuscripts, as I indicated, of the Old Testament, but these are the closest that we have, and they give us a preview of the absolute accuracy of the manuscript during this time period. The earliest previous manuscripts, with the exception of the Nash Papyri, were all from at least 900 A.D. and following. Now, what was found? Hundreds of manuscripts, mostly Old Testament, some manuscripts of every book of the Old Testament except Esther. For some reason, Esther wasn't one of their favorite books. See some complete manuscripts like Isaiah, the whole book of Isaiah. Some as early as 250 B.C., like the Exodus fragment, 4Q Exodus, and then 4Q Samuel 225 B.C. were the oldest pieces. Some apocryphal books were found, but it is believed that they did not consider the apocryphal part of the Bible because they never wrote any commentaries on the apocryphal books like they did on biblical books. And they never put apocryphal books on the special vellum manuscript, and they never used the special script that was reserved for inspired books. So they probably just had copies of these, but did not consider them inspired. There were some commentaries on Old Testament books and some Essene Qumran community rules. The Essenes were a Jewish sect that had broken away from the temple in Jerusalem, had gone out into the wilderness and lived their own little communal life there, somewhat like a Jewish cult, a Jewish messianic cult waiting for the Messiah to come. And the rules of their community were recorded in the Manual of Discipline, which was discovered. Where were these discovered? Well, Cave 1, 1949, was the discovery of Isaiah A and Isaiah B, the Manual of Discipline, some of Habakkuk, Genesis, Apocryphon, the War Scrolls, Thanksgiving Hymns, and a lot of other pieces of books here, including commentaries on Micah and Zephaniah. Cave 2, 1952, was explored. About 100 fragments of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Jeremiah, Job, Isaiah, and Ruth. Cave 3, the Copper Scroll, about 66 treasure sites were found. And Cave 4, thousands of fragments of hundreds of manuscripts, nearly 100 Bible books, all but Esther, were found. This was the big cache of manuscripts from Cave 4. Special favorites of the Qumran community: Deuteronomy, Isaiah, and Psalms happens to be the same books that Jesus quoted most often and were favorites of his. Cave 5, deteriorated fragments of some biblical books and apocryphal book of Tobit was found. Cave 6, papyrus pieces of Daniel, 1st and 2nd Kings. Cave 7 to 10, many fragments, some possibly early New Testament fragments, as we'll see later. Cave 11, most of Psalm 93 to 150, which is the last part of the book of Psalms. An apocryphal psalm, which is titled Psalm 151. Our psalm book ends in 150. And an Aramaic targum, or paraphrase, of the book of Job. Now, dating these Dead Sea Scrolls is quite a science. First of all, when they were discovered, carbon 14 was the best dating method. It's not now. And they were carbon 14 dated by Dr. Libby of University of Chicago between 167 BC and 233 AD. You can see it's quite a range. Now we were able to use the accelerator mass spectrometry 1991 and 1998, and they were able to narrow the dates down with a whole lot more precision to 202 B.C. to 93 B.C. And the Zurich and Tucson combined scrolls test reveal that. Handwriting also indicates that the books were written between 250 B.C. and 70 A.D. by the kind of script that was used. Pottery was found with them, indicates that it came from about 150 B.C. to 100 A.D. So you can see an overlapping of the accurate methods here, zeroing in on the same time period. The coins, you can always tell the coins because when the coins don't have any more emperors after that time, then clearly they were stored before the time of that emperor, 135 B.C. to 135 A.D. Type of cloth is from the same time period. So you have carbon 14, you have AMS method, handwriting, pottery, coins, cloth, and other manuscripts. There were some younger Muribat manuscripts found south of Bethlehem in 1952, and these were self-dated with the Roman dates that I've converted to our dates, 132 to 133, which places the Dead Sea Scrolls before this time. So you have other manuscripts to date them. And there's hardly a Doubting Thomas left that doesn't believe that these books come from a couple hundred B.C. to 100 A.D., more precisely 250 B.C. to 70 A.D. Now we have a look at the number and the nature of the manuscripts. Let's take a look at what we're really interested in. How accurately has the Bible been copied? And how do the Dead Sea Scrolls tell us about this accuracy? Well, we knew about the accuracy of the Old Testament before because we had the Greek translation of the Old Testament called the Septuagint. LXX means 70, supposedly 70 translators of it. So we had that, which was done about 250 B.C. to 150 B.C., so we knew by comparing the Greek translation of the Old Testament and the Hebrew that it was accurately copied. We also knew the practices of the Jewish scribes. They were very meticulous. If they made a couple errors, they had a whole manuscript, they had to throw it. They were very careful in their copying. And then we had another method of testing it, because there's some passages in the Old Testament that are recorded twice. Like Psalm 18 is also the same as 2 Samuel 22. And so you can look at copies of it and see whether they made a mistake on this one or made a mistake on that one. You had two to compare with. And then the large number of Hebrew manuscripts, we don't have just a handful, we have 10,000 manuscripts to compare one with the other. And the early date of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and then comparison with other ancient books. So we got plenty of evidence that the Old Testament has been accurately copied. But the best bit of evidence by far now is the comparison of the Dead Sea Scrolls with the manuscripts 1,000 years later. When you compare the Old Testament manuscripts with other manuscripts from the ancient world, you get a chart something like this. The number of manuscripts is in red, so in the Old Testament case you have 10,000. You can't see red on any other one, and the reason for that is it's be too small a sliver of red to put on there to be even able to see. Because in the case of Herodotus, we only had 8 manuscripts, Plato 7, Tacitus 20, Caesar 10, Pliny 7. The only two you can see are Demosthenes. He was the Greek orator. He used to put a pebble on his tongue and talk to the waves just to practice. We have 200. And then the most copied book from the ancient world, Homer's Iliad, 643 manuscripts. Now, they're all pathetic by comparison with the number of manuscripts of the Old Testament. 10,000 manuscripts of the Old Testament compared to, on the average, of 10 to 20 for most other books from the ancient world. Amazing comparison. Miller Burroughs, famous archaeologist who wrote one of the first books on the Dead Sea Scrolls, said, "It's a matter of wonder that through something like 1,000 years, the text of the Old Testament underwent so little alteration. Herein lies its chief importance, supporting the fidelity of the Masoretic tradition," that's the Jewish scribal tradition. So he said it's a matter of wonder, almost the word miracle, that in 1,000 years the text underwent so little change. Gleason Archer has a PhD from Harvard, who knew 30 languages, all of the biblical languages. He's the most brilliant linguist I've ever met in my life. It was my privilege to teach with him for years at Trinity Seminary. Gleason Archer said, "Isaiah proved to be word for word identical with our standard Hebrew Bible in more than 95% of the text. The 5% of variation consisted chiefly of obvious slips of the pen and variations in spelling." So for all practical purposes, 95% of everything, every jot and tittle, was identical. 5% were just stylistic changes that easily are done, and you can still understand what the original said. F.F. Bruce, famous British scholar, said, "It may now be more confidently asserted than ever before that the Dead Sea discoveries have enabled us to answer this question of the reliability of the Old Testament text in the affirmative with much greater assurance than was possible before 1948, even though we had pretty good assurance from those other methods." So what is the significance? Textually, the first and most important significance of the Dead Sea Scrolls is that it tells us that our Old Testament is a highly reliable copy of the original text. Only one real change in Isaiah 53 in 1,000 years. Now, Isaiah 53 is one of the most important chapters in the Bible. "He was wounded for our transgression, bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him. By his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray." You probably know it by heart as well. Well, in 1,000 years of copying Isaiah 53, there was only one word difference, the word light in verse 11, that doesn't affect the meaning at all. The whole book of Isaiah, all 66 chapters, only 13 changes in the whole book of Isaiah after 1,000 years of copying. Now, they didn't have Xerox machines. They had human beings copying these, which tells you how accurate they were. The differences do not affect the overall message of the book of Isaiah or of any single chapter. If you never had a Dead Sea Scroll, you would pick up the Bible and get exactly the same meaning, exactly the same doctrine out of it without the scrolls. They just tell us that they were extremely accurate. Some changes are helpful, even though they're not essential. For example, King James Version of Isaiah 33:8 said, "He hath broken the covenant, he hath despised the cities, he regarded no man." The RSV, based on the Dead Sea Scrolls, and that was the first translation to use some of the Dead Sea Scrolls in the translation, said, "Covenants are broken, witnesses are despised, there is no regard for men." Well, the word witnesses makes a whole lot more sense than the word cities there. Doesn't change the overall meaning of the passage, but it's more likely that the Dead Sea Scrolls preserves the correct reading of witnesses rather than the reading cities. This reading from the Dead Sea Scroll makes more sense, and it's incorporated into the NIV and the NET Bible. Historically, there's a very important significance of the scrolls. It confirms that the messianic prophecies existed long time before Christ. This is important for us apologetically because we believe that one of the greatest evidences that the Bible is the Word of God is predictive prophecy. That prophets predicted things hundreds of years in advance. and they were fulfilled exactly like they were predicted. Now, it was very difficult to prove one of our most important pegs of this argument before. And that is, it was very difficult for us to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that these prophecies were written before the time of Christ, because we didn't have any copies before the time of Christ. We just had copies of copies of copies. Now we have copies before the time of Christ, 250 years to 100 B.C., and guess what they show us? They show us that when the Old Testament predicted the Messiah was going to be born of a woman in Genesis 3:15, and later of the ethnic group of Abraham, Genesis 12, and later Genesis 49 of the tribe of Judah, and finally of the dynasty of David, 2 Samuel 7, and in fact, in the city of Bethlehem, Micah 5:2, even the wise men, you remember, came from the east, saw from the scriptures themselves where he would be born. How he would die, Isaiah 53, which we'll look at in a moment. When he would die, Daniel 9 says he would die about 33 AD. From 444 BC to 33 AD is exactly 483 years, which the prophecy predicted in lunar years. And there are nearly 100 of these predictions in the Old Testament. So now we have manuscripts that prove that these books existed before the time of Christ, some of them a couple hundred years, and that all of these predictions were made long before the time of Christ, and they were literally fulfilled in Christ, 100 of them, showing beyond question that this is a supernatural book. Let's take a look at Isaiah 53. Now, this is a picture right out of the Isaiah 53 scroll. In the top right, you can see their handwriting in red there, where 53 and 52 break, the chapters break. This is the translation made by unbelieving Jews and others of Isaiah 53. So it's not our translation or some conservative translation, but it's very similar. Official translation of Isaiah 53, who has believed our report and the arm of Yahweh, YHWH, called the tetragram. That's really the word for Lord, L-O-R-D, or Yahweh in the Old Testament. And you're familiar with the passage. There's the word light in verse 13. Of the toil of his soul he shall see, Dead Sea Scrolls adds light, and he should be satisfied. And by his knowledge shall he make righteous even my righteous servants. So with or without the word doesn't really change the meaning. So in 1,000 years of copying this chapter, that's the only variant we have in Isaiah 53. Now what I want you to look at is this Dead Sea Scroll translation of Isaiah 53. And I want you to look at two things. In red, we have every time it's referring to the Messiah. He, him, and notice it's in red and it's singular. And then in the green, we put groups. So if it's talking about a group of people, or if it's talking about the nation of Israel, or something else. Now, why do I do that? Why do I put the red, his and he, and then the green the other way? Because Jewish people today, if you at all witness to Jewish people, you'll discover that they say Isaiah 53 talks about the suffering nation, plural, not a suffering individual. But you can see it's the individual who's suffering. He shall grow up. God laid on him the iniquity of us all. We esteemed him beaten and stricken of God. And then he's talking about our iniquities, then he's talking about a broader group of people. So here is a single individual who is suffering for the whole group. He bore our sins. And notice what it says in the bottom. Words and phrases indicating a plurality of people are distinct from he, him, and his. His people, his generation, all of us, sins of many, great ones, wicked ones, transgressors, many and there. for example. So here we have clear indication that there was a prediction made about an individual Messiah, 100 B.C., which was literally fulfilled by Christ, and it sounds like it's a passage that could come right out of the New Testament, one of the real proofs of the Bible's supernatural nature. Messianically, they show that first century Jews expected an individual Messiah. The manuscripts show beyond question that in this community, they were looking not for the nation to suffer, but they were looking for an individual called the Son of God who was going to come and suffer for their sins. This person who is going to come, according to these scrolls, is going to be called the Son of God. Now, this was denied by Jewish people. It was denied by skeptics. Nowhere does it say that an individual Messiah is going to come and he's not going to be called the Son of God. Well, the Dead Sea Scrolls, our best evidence says, yes, it does. Who would bring in his kingdom. The Messiah would come and bring in his kingdom. And he would raise the dead. This Messiah would be able to perform miracles that no one else has ever been able to perform. He would even raise people from the dead. Let's take a look at some of these passages from the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Genesis Florigerium for Q 252, column 5. The government shall not pass from the tribe of Judah, Genesis 49. During Israel's dominion, a Davidic descendant on the throne shall not cease, 2 Samuel 7, the throne of David, until Messiah of righteousness, the branch of David, comes. Well, that's exactly what the Messiah is called in the Old Testament, the book of Isaiah and in Jeremiah 23. This is called the Son of God fragment for Q 246. Here's what it says. Also, his son will be called great and be designated by his name. He will be called the Son of God. They will call him the Son of the Most High. Their kingdom will be an eternal kingdom, and all their paths will be righteous. Amazing prediction right out of the Apocryphon of Daniel. And Daniel himself, you remember, said that in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed. And here it talks about the Son of the Most High coming to do that. The Messianic Apocalypse says, for he will honor the pious upon the throne of his eternal kingdom, release the captives, open the eyes of the blind, lifting up those who are oppressed. He shall heal the critically wounded. He shall raise the dead. He shall bring the gospel, good news, to the poor, right from the Dead Sea Scrolls. One can wonder how the community there, so oriented, if they hadn't been so isolated from Jerusalem and had really had an encounter with Christ, how they could fail to see that he was the Messiah. Well, some people think that maybe Jesus belonged to this community and maybe he got his ideas from the Essene community. This is clearly false, even though there are a number of books written on it. The similarities are only circumstantial and the differences are essential. First of all, some circumstantial similarities. Jesus spent some time in the wilderness of Judea. That's where he was tempted, Luke 4. So he was over in that area, at least for some time. Jesus made messianic claims and taught righteousness, just as the teacher of righteousness in this community did. But the differences stop very quickly, the similarities stop quickly, and the differences emerge. The Essenes emphasized hate one's enemies, and Jesus stressed loving them. He said, you have heard it was said, hate your enemies, but I say unto you, love your enemies. Clearly, he wasn't an Essene. The Essenes were exclusivistic regarding women, sinners, and outsiders, where Jesus was inclusive. He didn't mind hanging around with sinners. Remember, he was called a wine bibber because he hung around with people, and he was called a friend of sinners. Well, the Essenes wouldn't think of doing that. The Essenes were legalistic Sabbatarians, and Jesus was neither. The Essenes were very rigid, legalistic, pharisaical Sabbatarians with regard to working on Saturday, and Jesus, you remember, was deliberately healing people, his disciples plucking grains of wheat and everything to make a point. The Essenes stressed Jewish purification laws, and Jesus attacked them. He said, you got everything clean on the outside. You got the cup clean on the outside, and inside is full of evil. So he was just the opposite of the Essenes. The Essenes believed in two messiahs, and Christianity holds there was only one, Jesus. So clearly Jesus was not an Essene. Christianity didn't come out of the caves near Qumran, but they did have some interesting beliefs in a Messiah and in Old Testament prophecies that showed that they were at least looking for an individual Messiah. Well, then maybe John the Baptist was an Essene. If you can't get Jesus in there, then they try and get John the Baptist in there. Well, there's some similarities. John was born of priestly parents, and the Essenes were a priestly group. John ministered in the vicinity of Qumran, Luke 1:80 says. John preached that the time was at hand when the Messiah was coming, and so did the Essenes. Baptism played a prominent role for John and the Essenes. They had a baptismal tank there. John used Isaiah 40, verse 3, to proclaim the Messiah, and so did the Essenes. But there's some significant differences, and here they are. John proclaimed Jesus as the Messiah, and the Qumran community did not. They have no knowledge of Jesus, never proclaimed him as the Messiah, where John said, "Behold, the Lamb of God takes away the sin of the world." John proclaimed one Messiah, and Qumran had two. Now, you can speculate as to why they believed in two. Some say because there were Old Testament prophecies that predicted the Messiah would die, like Isaiah 53, and then there were some that said the Messiah would rise from the dead, like Psalm 2 and Psalm 16. And they said, well, the same person can't do that, so it'll take two Messiahs. That's one theory of how they got two Messiahs. Well, of course, you can have one Messiah if the first one dies, and he's the same one who rises from the dead, which Jesus was. John actively sought converts. He's around converting people, baptizing them, telling them to repent. And Qumran wasn't seeking converts. They were hiding away in the caves. They were an esoteric, isolationist cult. John preached in all the regions of Jordan, but the Essenes did not. They were only in this section where Jordan hit the Dead Sea. The Essenes baptized themselves, but John's converts did not baptize themselves. The Essenes had a little staircase going down into their baptismal tank, and they could walk down and then just dip themselves in the water. They did baptize by immersion, by the way, but they baptized themselves. There are a lot of books on the Dead Sea Scrolls. If you're interested in further reading, here are some you might look at. Particularly, I would recommend James Vanderkamp, The Meaning of the Dead Sea Scrolls. That's a real good one. But any of those in the last part of the column there would do. Sunrise over the Dead Sea, a beautiful area. They lived a lives of monks almost there. But you can thank God for this little sect that broke away from Jerusalem and preserved these manuscripts in the caves all of those years, thousands of years, so that somebody could break in, find them in 1947 and following, and that we could have this verification of the scripture.